Welcome, everyone, to a special episode of the AI in Business podcast. I'm Matthew DeMello, senior editor here at Emerge Technology Research. It's my great pleasure to announce the launch of the Trajectory podcast on the Emerge podcast platform today and introduce our CEO and head of research, Daniel Fajella, here to tell you all about it. Without further ado, here's Dan with a special sneak peek of the first episode.
This is Daniel Fajella, head of research at Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. You're about to hear from Dr. Yoshua Bengio of the University of Montreal, who is considered one of the godfathers of machine learning, among the most cited computer scientists of all time, a Turing Award winner, and someone who very recently has become rather concerned with the development of artificial general intelligence and what it means for humanity. The clip you're about to listen to is from an entirely new interview show focused on the longer-term consequences of artificial general intelligence and what kinds of futures of man and machine we want to head towards as a species. Admittedly, a little bit headier and a little bit bigger picture than some of our traditional kind of business use case AI and business episodes, and that's why we've broken it out into its own separate podcast. We've had some great and popular series called AI Futures in the past, featuring Stuart Russell, Ben Goertzel, Stephen Wolfram, many great names in AI. And now again, we're branching that off into an entirely different interview show. In this episode, you'll hear Yoshua Bengio talk about what shifted his view from artificial general intelligence being a non-reality, something he really wouldn't have to consider in his lifetime, to what makes it very much something he thinks could happen in the near term, that is to say, machines that are vastly capable and more capable than human beings in the near term. Also, Yoshua talks a bit about some of his policy considerations around how we should steer and buffer against vastly more capable AI, and what that might mean, again, for international policy and even for business leaders as well. We're only airing part of this episode. The Trajectory is often a show where we have 60 or 70 or 75-minute episodes, which is much longer than what we generally do here on the AI in Business podcast. We've kept this one closer to our original length for AI in Business, but if you want to hear the full episode, go to emerj.com/TJ2. That's T as in Thomas, J as in Jacob, and then the number 2, emerj.com/TJ2. It just stands for Trajectory. That'll take you to an announcement page for the Trajectory where you can check out the YouTube channel for the full video of this interview. You can sign up for the podcast on the Trajectory itself and listen to the full episode if you're interested. And we have a separate Trajectory newsletter you can check out there as well. It's emerj.com/TJ2. Let's fly right in. This is Yoshua Bengio with the Trajectory, and this clip is aired on the AI in Business podcast.
Dr. Yoshua Bengio, welcome to the show. Good to chat with you again.
Thanks for discussing with me.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since our lengthy conversation. I think it was actually 8.5 years ago or something like that, Yoshua. I looked it up. You know, the Turing Award has happened since then. All the innovations around attention have happened since then. So much progress has happened in this space. And we're going to get into the real meat and potatoes of where we're headed with AI. You've been speaking a good deal about policy. We're going to pull things up. But I want to talk first about what made the aha happen for you. I know it related to ChatGPT. The way it comes around in my mind is this. You folks were so close to the science that you guys made discoveries that made all of this happen. At the same time, we go back 10 years, there were people saying some of the things you're saying now. Maybe AI will have its own sense of self-preservation. Maybe it will engage in cyber attacks and biological warfare, and those might be serious risks. And that was, some of those conversations were older. What made it easier to progress in the science than in terms of seeing some of those considerations back then?
Well, I just made a blog post which goes into some of this, but let me explain a bit of that trajectory. First, I should have seen this coming earlier. And one of the things I've been writing about is why is it that I and others somehow looked the other way for many years? Well, one excuse, I think, which is the main reason why at least I didn't pay too much attention to those risks, is that it felt so far away in the future.
Yeah.
Like, I've been convinced for many, many years, not decades, that the brain is a machine. It's a biological machine. So there's no reason why, you know, we couldn't in the future build machines that are as smart as us. And then once we understand that, probably smarter than us.
Yeah.
But the things we were building, they were so stupid.
Yeah.
No, so this scaling thing isn't something we could do very much in academia.
No.
So the kind of models my student and I have been developing until recently, we couldn't see how they could be harmful. And in fact, a lot of my colleagues continue to think of it like this.
Yeah.
But with ChatGPT, it became clear to me that the horizon of when we could reach human-level AI could be much closer. And not only that, another reason why I, you know, revised my estimate is that I've been working since 2016, 2017 on how we bring something like reasoning into deep learning. Actually, the attention work from 2014 was the first step in that direction, because attention is one of the key ingredients of our kind of conscious processing. But I've been working, especially in the last 2 years, on new mathematical models for deep learning, which, if they pan out, could really change the game and deal with pretty much all of the issues we currently see with ChatGPT. When ChatGPT came out in November last year, my first immediate reaction was, oh, look, there are all these problems that I've been talking about for many years. You know, overconfidently wrong, you know, confabulation and out of distribution generalization that was not as good as humans, and many other things that people have pointed out. Difficulty when the system has to reason through many steps. Difficulty with doing math, for example. So I tried these things myself. In the first few months, I just played with it and tried to like nail the mistakes that it made. So I just focused on that. But eventually it dawned on me, like, you know, it takes a lot of hard work to make it fail. And the rest of the time, it's actually talking to me with pretty good English and even French, which I found really amazing.
Yeah, that's surprising.
I'm you know, that's my mother tongue.
Of course.
And so gradually I came to accept that, well, gee, we pretty much nailed language. So that's the Turing test. Now, you know, people disagree and, you know, yes, you can find failures and an expert will be able to like find the questions that make it fail. But for 90% of people, they would be fooled, except if they ask ChatGPT if it is a machine or a human, because it's not been trained for that. But it would be easy to design a version that would be kind of trying to pass for human.
Yes.
So that's already scary in itself. So I started thinking, oh, gee, we're entering a new era where misinformation could be scaled up. So it started with this. And I started talking to other people about this. And, you know, I'm in touch with folks at the Canadian government. And, you know, there are people starting to talk about legislation. I was involved with the Global Partnership on AI, which is an international mm-hmm. organization thinking about things like responsible AI. And so I started really going deeper into this and then thinking, but okay, so misinformation is one thing, but what if we actually, you know, go beyond mastery of language and we get things that can manipulate people better than people? What if we can get systems that can understand science better than people? And the reason why I was thinking about science is because for the last 3 years, because of the pandemic, I've been working on AI for science. Like, how do we use AI to design better antivirals, for example,
sure.
or you know, new drugs in general? And you know, there was this paper showing you can fairly trivially change the AI training and querying system so that instead of designing a cure, it would design a chemical weapon right?
Yeah.
So all of these things have made their way into my mind, and I realized that regulation takes a lot of time. Look at how much time we've had with climate change and decades, and we still haven't fixed it, even though we know how to fix it.
Yeah.
So I started getting worried about this and thinking that governments need to better understand the risks that are coming because of misuse, and potentially more. Something that I'm not, like, now I have read a lot of AI safety and so on, but before I didn't know much. I read Stuart Russell's 2019 book,
yep,
called Human Compatible,
and yep, yeah,
it was a really great lesson to understand some of the issues. But even though I understood at a intellectual level,
yeah,
this alignment problem, emotionally I still, like, I didn't change my trajectory.
Didn't seem like it clicked, like, for you. Yeah.
No, yeah. And it's just this ChatGPT basically and this trajectory during the winter that made me realize that I should really be coherent.
I'm with you, and I guess I wonder your take on this, because you're sort of hinting at it a little bit. We had Stuart on as basically right when that book was published on an earlier AI future series. You said the word trajectory a lot. Oddly enough, that's the name of this new entire media branch that we're doing specifically around the big picture of AI, so I like that word a lot. But yes, I wasn't seeing you in the dialogue then. You know, there's even going back before, I think Stuart was making a lot of noise about this, the Omohundros of the world and yes, Yosha Bach, and certainly Goertzel, and people have opinions about Goertzel. I have a lot of respect for the man myself, who were sort of talking about this grander explosion of intelligence. I almost wonder if you were banging away up in the frozen north for decades, moving inches in this core science, seeing it from the very ground up, and as you had said, building stupid things, you know, that were important and hopefully moving forward science. But the survey response from way back in 8 years ago about, what do you consider to be the most likely AI risk in the next 100 years? I had phrased it as 100 years, was too far off for me to say something meaningful.
That's what I would have said.
It's incredibly admirable that you've pivoted your position. I think many smart people do not, but you very clearly do, and you've been very open about that. And I think you're singular in terms of how quickly and how openly you've done that. But
well,
do you?
It's,
yeah, go ahead.
It's hard. It's hard to admit you were wrong. It's hard to
totally
admit that the work you've done, your identity, your beliefs. For example, my beliefs about open source, my beliefs about open science. My belief, I didn't really pay too much attention about dual use issues because, well, I was not into like nuclear physics or something.
Yeah.
But of course, now I do. And I think that, you know, we have cognitive biases that prevent us from being fully rational, that make us look the other way, that make us focus on things that are maybe give us comfort and don't require us to change our views.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah. So it's maybe in your perspective, it's less of seeing inchworm progress for the decades, but it's also, well, maybe it's partially that, but it's also just the challenge of having to come to grips with this. But you did, and now we're having this conversation. You've had many others, and I'm excited to unpack it. So now we'll get into the meat and potatoes. I appreciate All right. understanding your mental journey. I think about the sort of AI game in terms of the big picture. The big picture being, you know, there was once amoebas, now there's people. What's going on from here, right? I think that's the only game in town. That's my personal opinion. I think it's the only game in town. And I think that the answers to those questions are very big. And when you talk to people about near-term policy, it's almost like you drop them in a maze and you say, okay, do you want to go left or right? And
right. Maybe,
that's fine, but I think ultimately people have values decisions that they've made within their own heart, or they have an inclination that brings them somewhere, and everything they do is going to move them in that direction. I shared with you before we recorded the basic idea of this kind of intelligence trajectory political matrix idea, mm-hmm, where we have preservation of just pure humanity, some level of maybe cognitive upgrading and strong AI that serves humanity, and then really a pretty significant trajectory beyond people in terms of ascension. And then on the other strata, we've got total laissez-faire international approach, a kind of collaborative approach like we have now, the United Nations, things like that, and then maybe a more controlled approach where we really do have to batten down the hatches. When you think about what your heart calls for and sort of where you'd like us to move towards, what your intuition is, a better future, where do you land there?
Well, there's the heart and there's the kind of reason.
Oh, do them both. Do them both.
Right. So I've been such a strong proponent of openness for all my professional life. It's been one of the hardest things for me to accept that AI could be dangerous, could be dual use, just like any other powerful technology, but maybe more if it gets more powerful.
Certainly.
And so I've moved on the sort of control versus openness, towards the middle, let's say.
Yeah.
On the axis of preservation versus ascension, I'm a bit conservative in the sense that there's too much unknown about what kind of intelligence future, let's say, AI entities would create. I really don't have any idea. And I think I care too much about humanity to just forget that feeling. So I want clearly to preserve humanity, but I do think that technology can help us have better lives. But it can't be at the expense of losing humanity. So I guess I'm in the middle there as well.
Yeah. So I really appreciate. I could tell you've wrestled with these things, and I'm stoking the flames of I'm stoking embers that you've very recently been burning. You know, in terms of these logs. When it comes to the preservation of humanity, I think there's some folks who say, "Hey, no matter what, I don't care if it's my great 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 grandchildren's future. Humanity should not vastly augment ourselves and hand over the baton of power to something more capable than ourselves. That is just not something that should literally ever occur." There's other people who say, hey, right now, we should not blast off with an AGI that we don't understand. But over the course of decades, maybe centuries, if cognitive enhancement happens and we understand intelligence a little bit deeper, and then something greater is birthed that goes even farther, maybe there could be a trajectory of intelligence as there was before you and I, Yashua, right? There was Rodentia with, you know, sure, that little postage stamp of cortex. Now there's you and I, certainly you with much more than a postage stamp of cortex. And we might presume that there are post-cortex substrates, sure, that could house much grander things. Are you in that forever camp in terms of hominids as they are, or are you more in the let's be conservative for now camp?
I think we need to understand better before we move forward.
Okay.
And I do think that humanity could gain some sort of augmentation. It doesn't have to be biological. I mean, we're already doing it with technology. I mean, humans, we have many reasons to deplore a lot of human behavior.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to ask how we can kind of get some of these problems. I mean, so I've been in the camp for a long time and still think that education is a huge tool in making humans better. Bringing the kind of material well and psychological well-being at the top that humanity can enjoy for everyone. I mean, I would start with that, right? How far we can get with that. And who knows? I think technology could help us be better in many ways, but I think we do have to be prudent because we have so much at stake here.
I'm completely with you, and I think we do have a lot at stake. I guess if I'm putting this correctly for you, it's, hey, who knows exactly what the grand trajectory of intelligence is, but for the time being, let's not just blow through all the hurdles and just reach into. Because oddly enough,
I know some people who are
now,
like that.
There now is a camp there. Yeah, and you know, yeah, 10 years ago,
it's a very small camp.
It's small today, although I suspect it won't be small forever. 10, 15 years ago, there were actually very few of those people. There were a lot of people interested in making measured progress and eventually leading to a grand post-human trajectory, which I still think can be quite a noble vision. But there's now a subset today that are all about as soon as possible, no matter how little we understand about it, no matter what the immediate risks are, just pedal to the metal. And I think that that's a position that some people now hold. They want to rush directly to ascension.
So here's an emotional response about this.
Yes.
I have children. I have a grandchild.
Yeah.
I think of all the beauty that exists in the world in the eyes and the hearts of humans. I don't want to risk that. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't work to improve the condition of humans and improve the kind of intelligence of what we do, or, you know, maybe our descendants. But I think there's so, you know, we have 8 billion beautiful human beings out there, and we should not play lightly with that.
I'm with you. I think that complete willy-nilly roll the dice is a wild position to hold. But at the same time, I've heard strong arguments where people have said, I think when people do have children and grandchildren, I think there is a more natural inclination away from progression and certainly ascension and closer to preservation. I can't say that biological gut instinct is necessarily the sparklingly brilliant moral compass, because I think, Joshua, we could probably agree that biological impulses may or may not be the grand sparkling moral compass that we would want to make all decisions by, but it's understandable. Yeah. I have also seen people with sparkles in their eyes make the following argument. Why, at some point, there was something vastly below rodentia that could experience no higher bliss than eating a tree root or mating for half a second. And that was sort of the totality of sort of sentient upside. And now you and I, we can enjoy having this intellectual discussion. You can go home and enjoy playing a game of chess. You can make scientific discoveries and enjoy it. Poetry, art, myriad possibilities. The potential and capability of our form is such a panoply. It's not just more of what the rodent has. It's entirely new magazines of richly worthy sentient experience and ability. And to cap the continual blooming of that, which hath bloometh since long before you and I were here, would be a travesty. Do you see any credence to that in the longer term, assuming we understand the technology, or would you argue against that standpoint?
I would argue neither. I think that we need to understand better. Like, I'm a scientist, and I think also from a philosophical point of view, before acting, you need to understand. That's the whole point of science.
Sure. So certainly for today, you're like, Dan, I'm not going to put the pedal to the metal. Completely understood. But I guess what you're getting at is, I can see that those things might be worthy, but honestly, we don't understand this stuff well enough. We need to really look at it and understand it first. So it sounds like open to the fact that we are part of potentially a blooming trajectory that happened before you and I, but that we shouldn't just jump into that stream and make it go forward. Great. So now I think I understand where you sit on the map. I think the cool thing about that, Joshua, is when I see what you post on Facebook and drop comments and whatnot, I'll sort of know the direction that you're headed in, not just your individual decisions about individual things. And I think that's incredibly useful. In terms of facilitating this conversation and getting to understanding, one of the other things I want to sort of talk about here is how we encourage people to have these tough conversations. Some of what's been fun about watching you turn on to the ideas of AI risk is sitting side by side with some of your friends in Montreal, or even folks like Andrew Ng, who famously, you know, equates AI risk to overpopulation on Mars, right? Even when Stuart Russell was very far down this train, Andrew was not. And Andrew seems like an incredibly kind and nice guy, but just, you know, was kind of shooting down these ideas very willy-nilly. You've had this ability to get people to at least intellectually engage, to make it less about pure right and wrong, who's going to call the other person dumb, and more about what is the common ground? What can we discover here? What should we understand here? What for you has been key in facilitating that?
Well, I think in order to be a good scientist and also take good moral decisions, you have to recognize that you can be mistaken. And you have to recognize that there could be multiple standpoints that are equally consistent with logic and data. Sometimes maybe you fixate on one standpoint. This is the way usually human brains work. We tend to adopt an idea, a way to interpret the world, and when someone else has a different interpretation, we enter into an argument. That's very natural and human. But there is a way to think about this mathematically, actually. This is the Bayesian posture, which says, if there are multiple ways to interpret the world, the data that we have about it, and they're all consistent with that data, and they are, you know, each is self-consistent, then you shouldn't be picking just one of them. You should be somehow bringing all of these points of view into the decision you're going to take. So in your figure, you also had this authoritarian kind of row.
Certainly.
It is bad for that reason, because there will be one person or a small group of people who will take decisions, and they will tend to focus on one interpretation of how things, you know, are.
Yeah.
Democracy is the opposite. It's about checks and balances where, okay, we disagree, we agree to disagree, we respect each other, and somehow we come to a consensus in action. So what can we do that's not disastrous for anyone's point of view, at least as little as possible, right? And I think this is how we should handle these debates, these disagreements. Well, first we need to recognize there is strong emotion. So earlier in our discussion, we talked about the emotional aspects that make us sometimes a bit blind to things, or difficult to change our mind. But second, we need to recognize that there are multiple scenarios that are all like plausible and different interpretations. And so long as the arguments stand logically and they are consistent with things we know, and you can't reject these arguments, then you have to embrace them. You have to embrace other people's views as well. And it's difficult, but that's a lot of how science works. It's a lot of how democracy works. So that's how I'd like to see those discussions go forward. We accept to actually listen to the other's arguments and think them through, seeking truth rather than trying to be the one who's right.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you my gut instinct about why this has worked for you and see if you think this is right in terms of why you've been able to get people who haven't necessarily been putting this on the table and picking it apart in an open and rational way, kind of without emotion. There is the factor, which is somewhat obvious, that it's Yahshua Ben-Gio coming in and starting this conversation. So we have that, but let's leave that off the table for now. I see two things. I'd love to know if you would agree with this or disagree. Two things that have made other people open up and be really receptive to your level-headed, let's really talk about this way of thinking. One is that you've actually recently changed your mind. You have not sat in a camp and stuck it out in one way. And I hope that I, and maybe the people listening, have the courage to do exactly the same thing if the facts demand it. But you've done that yourself. Number two, I think you haven't come in to these conversations to people and said, you need to look at both sides of the fact. It has felt more like you've just communicated more offline and be like, let's actually just get together about this and just taken off the heat of, you know, you're not on Twitter, but you shouldn't be, Joshua. It's not a good place. I'll tell you right now. It's not a great place. You're better off for not being there. But you've done the opposite of what Twitter is, which is quick quips back and forth. And some of your peers, who I think are wonderful people, you know, are certainly doing a bit of that. And you've more just kind of engaged one-to-one. So it's felt like you have the credibility of changing your own mind and the wherewithal to say, let's be respectful. I'll listen to you. Let's just sit down. Tell me if I'm wrong, but those from the outside have appeared to be your secret weapons.
Well, I don't think it's secret. It's the way science should proceed. And I think that's the way politics should proceed, ideally. But it's difficult. You have to sometimes go against your gut reactions of trying to argue one way or the other. But we have to take the time to sit down in person.
Yes.
Yeah, and listen, and also take the time to think through this. Like, some of my realizations have taken time.
Yep.
I've moved, and you need to, sometimes it takes time to digest complicated ideas. It takes time to digest difficult emotions. It takes time to think through possibilities, a lot of walks in nature. That's my trick. That's the other weapon.
I like it. I like it.
You need to take that time. And one problem is if you paint yourself too strongly as an advocate of one view, it gets harder to then change, because you've painted yourself in a corner.
Yeah.
And ego is ego. And, once you've committed publicly for one view, it's really hard to change. So we should try to avoid that.
So you're saying we should, for scientists or people in the field, not to say, I carry the banner of this political stance or this idea of the science, but say, this is my current perspective on.
Yeah, or I currently view things this way.
Yeah.
Which leaves you the room for changing your mind 6 months later.
It absolutely does. And I have a pretty rough feeling, and I don't know if you'll disagree, that a lot of the polarization that we're going to see on that quadrant that you and I just talked about for a second, the loud versions of that dialogue, I'm sure there's much softer versions that are not like this. The loud versions are very much about locking into a square, right? Political positioning is about, I'm all about openness and acceleration, and there is no time where anything other than those two things are the best. Pedal to the metal, let's go. And then there's other people who are in the anything that is intelligent in any way beyond humanity from now until the end of time is an absolute, defiance of God or defiance of what's best for humanity, and we should not even be thinking about it. And I'm going to lock myself into some kind of authoritarian kind of control scenario of preservation. I wonder if one of the ways to loosen that up is to encourage more of the way of thinking that you're exemplifying here, which is being able to move yourself. But I wonder if people can do that.
Yeah. Well, we can try. A whole lot of philosophies to help us do that. But I want to add another thing. Sometimes things are more complicated than what may transpire in immediate like debates or arguments. So let me give an example that's a very difficult question that has been very difficult for me, and where there's a lot of opposition, for example, between my friend Jan Lekern and myself.
Yes.
It's the open source question.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about that. And I want to use it to illustrate that sometimes it's like neither... It's not like one side is right and the other is wrong, or vice versa. It's something much more complicated. So here's my current view on this question, and I'm happy to change my mind if I understand better.
I'm glad to hear that.
So it's all about the level of danger of the technology. So if the technology that we can share, open source or whatever, maybe algorithms in the paper, weights of LLM, whatever it is that we share, if the technology can be dangerous, say, in the wrong hands, there are different levels of danger. Like, a gun can be dangerous. A nuclear bomb is much more dangerous. So there are different levels of danger. And my current view is that if the thing we would like to potentially share, because like we all want to share, like, I mean, scientists want to share, like, yeah. we want others to know what we've been doing, and, you know, we're proud of our work. We want others to build on what we've done. But if the technology we want to share is below a threshold, then the benefits of open source dominate. Like, there are lots of benefits. It accelerates the progress. It builds up a kind of immune system, because if you share and there are some bad actors who use that, then there are, you know, lots of other people who also have access to that code and can help defend, because it's like cybersecurity, right? Yep. Lots of people having access to the code, they can also find failures or fixes, or, you know, so being open sometimes is a very good defense. But if the technology is above that threshold of danger, then it's not clear anymore whether you should share, and maybe you shouldn't. And to make that maybe more concrete, I'm going to give you an example. Let's say that you're learning to swim, but you don't know yet. You're not very good yet. So you could go into a place where it's not dangerous, because you know go into a pool. There's somebody by the pool if in case you're in trouble. And yeah, maybe you're going to drink some water. That's the worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, you should jump in the water, right? You should take the risk, because you're going to be learning and get better. Just like if we share code that could be misused, like current LLMs, I think if they're shared, it's actually beneficial. And yeah, maybe some people are going to be misusing that, but we can probably defend, and we'll defend better. So on that, I agree with Jan. But what I think is that there's a point, and I don't know where it is, which is part of the problem, where we shouldn't be sharing anymore, where the capacity is too large. So it's like instead of jumping into the nice pool with someone who can watch over you, you're, you know, dropped in the middle of the ocean in the middle of a big storm.
Yeah.
That's not a good idea, right? So there are risks that you don't want to take, even though, yes, you know, taking risks is... part of learning is taking risks, but sometimes the risks is too high, and you would if you lose your life, your learning is useless.
I'm completely with you. I think the analogy sticks, and then I think there's a small band making the argument that no matter how big the storm, if we can throw ourselves into it, the storm will blossom into something grand and drastic and take over the galaxy, and that'll be great. And I'm not against the idea of post-human intelligence.
If they could prove that to me, I'll be happy.
Sure, exactly. And I think that's a bit of the challenge, right? If current LLMs scaled up to infinity, we're not sure that's going to be a blossoming of pure goodness or even of continued power into the galaxy. It sounds like, again, you're not against the idea that eventually that might be where we go, but certainly that right now we're in tremendous danger. We've got to get a better grasp on this stuff. This takes us a little bit to some of what you'd mentioned in the Senate. So you put up a short blog post summarizing some of this, and I thought it was worthwhile and something that we'll probably link to in the show notes. You talked about international governance structures that kind of go beyond current kind of voluntary opt-in things. You know, the OECD has their values, for example. I think you and I are both involved in the Futures Group with the OECD, yeah. Been over there on the value side for the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, important work, maybe not quite as strong as what you're talking about right now. You also talked about global research around governance and risk, and then you mentioned research and development specifically to counter kind of rogue AI and some of these bigger yeah. threats. There are some folks who would say, and indeed have argued, that the prevention of any of those risks would really require a degree of Orwellian control that would be almost unbearable, because we're not talking about nuclear materials yeah. here, right?
We're talking about the Nick Bostrom story.
Yeah, and you've brought up some of the analogy to nukes and why it's not like nukes in the past. Or that's been part of discussions you've had before. Do you see this as something, this opportunity to Toby Ord, also in that OECD group of ours, he talks about kind of, I think, the long pause or something like that, where humanity thinks about where do we ultimately want to go? In other words, what is the trajectory across the game board that we actually want to start moving across? Seems very similar to your take. Do you think that such a pause is viable in a collaborative international order versus a control one? Some people are happily saying it needs to be more control in order for us to be safe, but what is your perspective?
Okay, so control is not a black and white thing.
Certainly.
We have a lot of control in our current society. You know, we control how planes are built and who is allowed to drive them.
Absolutely.
And we can reconcile democracy and decentralization of power, which is really what democracy is about, with some level of control to protect the public. And in a way, what I'm talking about is that kind of thing. I'm not talking about bringing an authoritarian regime. In fact, I think it would be dangerous. So I don't trust authoritarian regimes to do the right thing for the people in terms of AI safety. There are two reasons for this. So one is the authoritarian regimes are too obsessed with their own survival. They don't want to be replaced by someone else.
Yeah.
And so their priority is that rather than the well-being of the people, which is hopefully what politicians should be elected for. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Oh, the Winston Churchill quote, right?
Yes, exactly.
So
that's one reason why authoritarian regimes are dangerous from the point of view of the survival of humanity. If we get to the point where we have very powerful AI systems smarter than us and so on, it's the wrong regime to be in, because it's not going to take the right decisions. It's going to be obsessed by its own survival. Also, it's going to take wrong decisions because of the, it's not Bayesian thing. You know, it's going to adopt one interpretation of things, and it is not going to consult, maybe have a wiser kind of decision-making process. And because of that, it's going to make mistakes. And in fact, authoritarian regimes make mistakes.
Yeah.
Right? And it's costly for their people. I mean, there's a lot of evidence for that. So when the cost is maybe, you know, material development is one thing. When the cost is the survival of humanity, I think it's really something to avoid. So I think we should design whatever we're going to be doing in terms of AI safety, political coordination, internationally and nationally, we need to design it so that it is not going to lead to authoritarian regimes. And of course, authoritarian regimes can use AI to help stay in power, which is another component of the problem.
I'm completely with you there. And by the way, bringing up this topic, I was in no way making the supposition that you were pro-authoritarian.
No, but I think it's important to explain why it's a bad idea.
Sure. No, I'm with you. And I'm completely on board with what you'd mentioned. I think there are absolutely reasons to suspect that it wouldn't be the best way to even get to safety. I guess that brings us to, and there's probably a little bit of a way to nutshell some of your thinking here. What, you know, democracy being a controlled sort of decentralization of power, it allows for dynamism, and it also allows for some degree of safeguarding. And this has been pretty productive, economically and otherwise, sciences, et cetera, et cetera. And so thank goodness you and I live in at least nominal democracies in some way, shape, or form.
We'll wrap up this clip of Yoshua Bengio here on the AI and Business podcast. I hope you got something out of that episode. I spoke with Yoshua some 8 or 9 long years ago when artificial general intelligence was not on his mind at all. And now when I'm at the OECD, I see him speaking very fluently about the considerations of post-human intelligence. And it's great to be able to have his voice in the dialogue. There's a lot of important considerations around what sort of futures between man and machine we ultimately want to create. What sorts of machines are we creating that might populate the galaxy beyond us? And I thought Yoshua did a pretty good job of being able to unpack some of the fundamentals in this particular episode. If you want to hear the full thing or watch the full interview on video, you can go to emerj.com/TJ2. That's T as in Thomas, J as in Jacob, and then just the number 2. And again, full video, you can sign up for the full podcast on the trajectory and check out the separate trajectory newsletter. I know that some of you on the AI and Business podcast are interested in the far future. I am grateful for that, and I'm grateful that we have this whole new media branch specifically catering to ultimately where this tech is steering us. I think that the near-term implications in business are incredibly important. This is sort of defining the footprint of the technology, but ultimately where we're headed is also a discussion we should not hold off on. And again, glad to be able to carry that conversation forward, and extremely grateful to Dr. Bengio for being able to join us here on episode episode one. It has been 8 long years since I've interviewed him, and it was a pleasure to have him back. So thanks so much for tuning in. We will air some other clips from The Trajectory in the future, but I'm glad you were able to be here for this one. So thanks again so much. We'll catch you soon.